This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to The Journey. I'm your host, Chris DeMix. And this is where I pick the brains of your favorite musicians about their musical paths, from the very beginning and throughout the years, up until the present. How they got from point A to point B, from their earliest musical memories, that very first song they remember hearing, to who influenced and inspired them. The moment they knew they wanted to be a performer, what led them to their instrument of choice, embarrassing first recordings, performances, and everything in between. When they fully realized this was a pure, unadulterated passion, way more than just a fleeting hobby or something they enjoyed in passing. We go deep and get the inside scoop of how, why, and when this all began. No two stories are the same, each unique to the individuals telling them, and everyone as fascinating as the next. So join me now as we embark on another journey. Well, hey, everybody, welcome to The Journey. And today's journey includes my guest, JR, who also plays in Less Than Jake on the saxophone. How's it going, buddy?
I'm pretty good, Chris. Thank you for having me on your podcast, finally.
No problem. It's about time, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I know that you how you do things and, you know, Rogers, you know, if there's a difference between me and Roger, you know, and it's top of the table, bottom of the table. So I get it.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Difference is his hair stinks, yours doesn't.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right. We got to edit that out. Anyhow, you know, it's funny. I had talked to Buddy, and I'm going to eventually get to everybody in the band. But, you know, having known you almost 30 years now, there's things about you, as I was thinking about this, that I just don't know. I told Buddy the same thing, and how I don't know some of this stuff is crazy, because we've certainly spent enough time in cramped quarters together. But, you know, we're going to go all the way back to the beginning, and I just want to ask you, do you remember the first song that you wanted to hear over and over again? That song that gave you goosebumps, the hairs on the back of your neck standing up, that you just had to hear again?
Man, it was The Reflex by Duran Duran. I could get enough. Seven and the Ragged Tiger, I could not get enough of that particular song. Like, I loved music, you know what I mean? There was always stuff that I, you know, stood out, you know. But when you say, like, that song that I couldn't get enough of, it was The Reflex by Duran Duran. That was the song.
And now, did you have cable TV in 83 when that record came out? Okay, so you had MTV.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, because in Florida, you know, I didn't get MTV till like the mid to late 80s. I had to go to like friends' houses that lived like three neighborhoods over where the cable stopped.
I'll give my father a lot of credit. You know, he's not here anymore, but he was always ahead when it came to like technology and all that stuff. So we had cable pretty early on in my childhood. I would say 82, maybe 81, somewhere around there.
Wow. Okay. You would have been my envy. And we didn't get cable. My grandmother's house had cable, so I had to go over there and watch MTV. So, you know, what was it about that song? Was it the song and the video? Do you remember what attracted you to it?
I really loved the bass line in that song. For some reason, there's like, you know, yeah, when it goes to that little pre-chorus part, doom 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 doom. And then the it was hook after hook after hook. And then when it pops into that chorus, you know, like, I think there's a modulation there. I've never actually like analyzed the song to figure it out, but there's something when it pops into The Reflex, it's massive, you know? So it just always stuck in my head. I don't know. It just was one of those songs. I couldn't stop listening to it, you know?
Were you one of those kids that air guitared in front of the mirror?
Nope, never air guitar. No,
that wasn't your thing. Okay,
no,
okay.
But I played piano. I didn't play guitar, so it wasn't. Yeah.
Which that leads me into my next thing. I was gonna ask you is, what was your first instrument? Was it the piano?
Yeah, I played piano. My mother's cousin married a man, and that man's mother was a piano teacher. And so we all of my cousins went to this woman and we learned how to play piano from like age 5. She taught everybody. And I probably studied with her till I was about 13, you know, like once you got to middle school, piano wasn't cool anymore.
Well, it's interesting watching you play. And for anybody out there that doesn't know, JR does any kinds of keyboards that we have on Less Than Jake Records. You're always the one, the go-to, you know, piano parts or keyboard parts that we add to the songs. And yes, we do add those sometimes. And it's interesting to watch. I can tell that you've been around the block on the piano, but you don't play that much. You're a little rusty. You have to really kind of sit there now and work through the parts. Was there one point where you were playing all the time? Obviously, because you seem like you know your way around the instrument.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's stranger as you get older. You don't do the things that you once did, you know. But for me, it's like it became easier to play guitar. In a chordal sense, you know, trying to figure out chords and stuff. I always say I play guitar like a caveman. And then if I want to expand like harmonically what I'm doing, I move over to the piano because that's when I can add different tensions and you can do different, like, you know, you have a broader palette of tones that you're able to work with. So I'm not as fluent on the piano as I was maybe when I was in college, but I don't play as often. And there's just not a keyboard readily available when we're on tour, you know? And so who the hell's going to pull out an 88 key keyboard on the, in the back lounge of the bus instead of a, you know, you can't travel with it. That's not going to fit in the overhead, you know? So
they have those blanket keyboards now you can roll out and they actually, you know, I don't know if you've seen those or not.
But, yeah.
I need to get you one of those.
it's weird too, because, you know, like there's something to be said about playing a piano versus a keyboard, because a piano, the keys are weighted and it feels different. You know, it's like anything else. It's all feel and whatever.
When did you know you had a voice you could hear pitch? Which, by the way, I would argue probably one of the best out of the three of us in the band on pitch. I mean, you really hear things and you really, you know, you can sing really well.
Well, thank you. That's nice of you to say. Finally, it's only taken you 20 years, but
yeah, it's on record now.
Yeah, now it's on record. I got it. But, you know, I don't know. I probably started singing younger than maybe it was about the same time. 7, 6, but we used to, and my mother was really active in our church, and there was a youth choir, and she would say, go sing in the choir, you know? And so I did, and they would give me solos, and I didn't know why they would give me solos versus other people. You know, I just was confident in singing.
Because little Johnny sucked.
Yeah, well, like, probably, you know? Like, but then
you were better than him.
And so I remember in like 7th grade, I tried out for chorus, right? And so my music teacher in 7th grade, I still speak to him. And I remember he had me sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee. That was the song. And after I sang it, he was like, I got to tell you, that's the best My Country, 'Tis of Thee I've heard all day. And he probably sat through 75 auditions that day, you know? And he's like, really? No, he's like, you got the tone, you got the intervals and everything. He goes, Peter, you have to keep singing or whatever. And I was like, well, thanks. And I will, you know, and I never thought of it. It was just something that always kind of came naturally to me. So I never really thought about it one way or the other. You know what I mean? It was just something that I did. So, you know, and I guess in hindsight now, I should just be happy that I was able to do it, because it's really hard to sing in tune in time. It's very difficult, you know, so.
If you were to pick one side of the family, your mom or your dad's, who do you think most of the musical talent came from? What side?
Neither. I don't know. The mailman. The mailman. Maybe that's who my father was. I, you know, there was always music around, but like, I can't say that there was one side that was more musical than the other. Maybe my mom's side, but I mean, I don't know.
I'm always curious about that question when I talk to people about that, because I know where mine came from. My parents were performers. My mom and dad both sang, and my mom's dad could sing really well. And I got uncles and aunts that can sing. So do you remember the first performance on TV or live that you saw where you're like, I want to do that, where the light bulb went on?
Yeah, there was a show on television called Kids Incorporated. Hey. remember that show?
Okay. I do.
And I remember these kids would get up on stage at their local soda shop or whatever the hell that place was that they performed, and they perform in front of all their friends, and they thought that, you know, their friends thought they were so cool because they would dance and sing or whatever. And I was like, I want to do that. You know, I want to get on stage, dance and sing or whatever. You know, it seems so juvenile, but truly that's what it was. And then I guess years later, I saw Fishbone play, and I saw Angelo Moore jump off whatever he jumped off of. And I was like, I want to do that, you know? And I mean, it's obviously that's two totally different things, but the initial spark was watching that show and going, I could do that.
Right. Well, we're going to get to those later rock and punk and ska shows. But the reason I asked that was because, you know, I want to know, like, the first time you got on stage, was it like a recital playing piano, singing, or, you know, was there one you were in the class play where you danced or had the lead in a play or something? Do you remember your first time on stage where you got that rush?
Yeah. I mean, we played when I was in high school, there was a talent show, variety show that they did every year. And I remember playing my junior year, and the band, actually, if I look at it now, today versus then, you know, like the guy that was the leader of the band, the drummer, his name's Jim Obelon, and he was Paul Simon's drummer.
Okay.
You know? And then the bass player was my friend Mike Woods, who you're familiar with.
Of course.
He played in Damone. And then the trumpet player in the band was my friend Anthony Rossomondo, who was the guy who wrote that song Shallow for A Star Is Born for Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. Mm-hmm. You know, that was won tons of awards. And then a couple other friends of mine that we were in, you know, high school together. And we just played like a funk group that we did, like we would play this song in the band, in the stands during football games. We were in the marching band, and we just decided to do like a variety show version of it. We, you know, we all dressed up stupidly or whatever, but like it was fun, you know. And we played like a Parliament song, and we played this other song, and then we played, I can't remember what it was, there was maybe an Aretha Franklin song that we did. We were like a backing band for a friend of ours that sang. And I remember just getting like a real rush from being on stage in front of all these people. And I was like, this is something I really like, you know? And I think pretty shortly after that is when I joined my first band with those same, pretty much that same group of people.
And, you know, you're most well known as a professional saxophone player. When was the first time you put a sax in your mouth and tried to blow through a reed?
It was just going into May of 1989, I guess. Sounds right. Maybe 88. And my music teacher was like, I played clarinet because the reason I played clarinet is when they go to rent instruments to kids, they only have a certain amount of instruments that were available to rent. I wanted to play saxophone, so did everybody, but they ran out of saxophones to rent. And somebody said, oh, play clarinet. It's pretty much the same. It's not pretty much the same, but it's close, but it's not. And so finally I'm sitting there in a lesson, my sixth grade year going into my seventh grade year. So maybe this is, yeah, it's probably 88. And my teacher, Fred, goes to me, Peter, have you ever considered playing saxophone? You know, and inside, internally, I was like, oh my God, yes. Outside, I was like, yeah, I thought about it. And he's like, well, we have a tenor saxophone here that the school owns. Why don't you go take it out? And so I took it out and I played it, and it just felt natural, you know? And he's like, well, take it home for the summer. And I just wouldn't put it down that summer.
I mean, but by this time, by 89, you're like 14 years old. So like you're a late bloomer to an instrument like that. I mean, a lot of kids are starting way younger. And the fact that you were able to take it and run with it, as you said, it was kind of natural to you, right?
It's like being a race car driver, I guess, you know, and wanting to drive a car for so long. And then you start off as a little kid and you drive the little race tracks or whatever. And then you just kind of build up. And it was kind of the same thing with a clarinet moving into a saxophone. It's like it trained me to know what this was, you know, and it actually playing a clarinet is a little more complicated than playing a saxophone. It's the same functionality or whatever, but the fingering is all different. you know, so it actually was easier for me to play the saxophone because the fingerings are a little more, they're less complicated, I should say. So right. It was easier for me to pick it up. But, you know, it just, it takes time like anything.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more. DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities, from easily paying collaborators with splits to securing your music with DistroLock. DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with a Spotify Canvas generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/demakes.
Do you remember the first rock or pop concert show you saw? And how old were you?
I was kind of late to that too. I feel it was like early 90s, 90, 91. So I lived kind of, I lived in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. So for me to get anywhere, it was, you know, I either had to get a ride or have my parents drive me. And my parents weren't so hip to bring me down to the major city, which was New Haven here in Connecticut, that often to go see concerts. So I was probably 17.
Yeah, okay. And I feel your pain there because I was closer to 15 because Tampa was 2 hours from Port Charlotte. That's even farther than Hartford. So
yeah.
I feel you there. I was kind of, I didn't really get into shows. Man, when I went to Gainesville, it just, everything exploded. And hence why my college career didn't take off. But so.
Yeah. And I can't, and like I said, I can't remember who I went to see, but I know it was down in New Haven and I think it was at the Tune-In
okay.
at the time.
Well, you know, that area, New England, especially for ska, as you know, has just been a hotbed. And you're already talking about your first band. You're kicking around with Mike Woods. You're kicking around with a guy that ends up writing songs for Lady Gaga. There's talent there. And then your first ska band was called JC Super Ska, which for, I guess, lack of a better word, morphed into Springheel Jack.
Well, no, there were two different bands, right? So when we first started, there was two ska bands in the state of Connecticut. There was Springheel Jack and there was JC Super Ska. But we all knew each other really well because, again, there was only two ska bands really at the time. So we played a ton of shows together, you know.
Okay.
And so there was people that Chris Rhodes, who's in the Boston's, he was always in Springheel Jack. Right. And that's how I met him, was playing shows, or how I met them was playing shows back and forth.
And we played with them before you were in the band.
Yes, you did. Yes, up in Studio 158, Willimantic, Connecticut.
Old Charlie.
Which also no longer exists. Yes, Old Charlie. I wonder about him sometimes. But yeah, I mean, it was two different bands. And so, but you know, like Rhodes would come and he would sit in with us and play songs. And then I would go sit in and play songs with Springheel Jack. And there was always like a little friendly competition between the two bands. But, you know, Jack was more ska punk, I suppose, and Super Ska was more of that traditional slackers, Scottalites type ska, you know what I mean? Like maybe a little more swing based. And so what happened there was Super Ska started musically, it just wasn't really vibing with what I wanted to do. And you know, Springheel, I liked the music more. It was more accessible to me.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And there was some things going on. And so finally I just like hit my breaking point with JC Super Scott. And I said, that's it, I'm done. And pretty quickly after that, I joined Spring Hill Jack. You know, they were like looking for a sax player and I just happened to be available. And I was like, I'm going to move on in my life, you know?
Right. And I know you know this, but for the listeners, you know, your band, Spring Hill Jack, to me and to a number of people I remember talking to about it, you guys had the best horn section. I mean, Rhodes went on to the Boss Tones. He's the sixth honorary member of Less Than Jake, comes out and plays with us. You play with the Boss Tones, kind of interchangeable there. Then you got Tyler Jones, rest in peace, who went on to play with Real Big Fish, who was a phenomenal player. The breadth of talent in that band was insane. I remember you guys played the 99 Warped Tour. You were out there. Less Than Jake was on it. We were in Orlando. That's the first time I remember really meeting you. And it was a short, what, within a year?
We were on for, I think we were on like 5 days or something like that. But then within like a year after that, I think I joined Less Than Jake.
And we were looking for a sax player. And I remember the first guy said, him, Pete, we were still calling you Pete at that time. You weren't JR yet. I said, Pete from Spring Hill's our guy, you know, again, just goes to show you what talent that we remember from Spring Hill. When you were out with Spring Hill, you know, because you guys had a moment. Ska punk was just, it was at the apex. It was kind of going crazy late 90s. You guys were on Moon Ska. You got a deal with Ignition Records, which I believe was a subsidiary of Tommy Boy or something to do with that.
Correct. Yes, correct.
Okay. Was there a moment at that time where you're like, okay, there's something here and I this might be a viable career choice?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we signed everything. The trajectory was up, you know, and we signed to this fledgling label called Ignition. And the reason we signed to it is because they only had two other artists signed. There was a group called BTK, and then there was another group called Anthrax. And guess which band that we wanted to sign with? Because you know what I mean?
Anthrax.
Like, we're like, fucking Anthrax! You know, we used to do a cover of I'm the Man. That, I don't know if you ever, I should show you a recording of that sometime. I think I have it somewhere. But we were huge Anthrax fans. We're like, good enough for Anthrax, good enough for Spring Hill Jack.
Yeah.
You know? And we were given the opportunity because we had a friend of ours who was an engineer. We had this opportunity to record the record that we did for Ignition at the Hit Factory in New York City.
Yes.
So, you know, for all intents and purposes, like, what was that movie that they did, Dave Grohl did about, what was, is that studio out in Los Angeles?
Oh, Sound City.
Sound City, right?
Yeah.
So the Hit Factory is New York City's Sound City, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody fucking recorded there. That was, you know, Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life was recorded there. Bruce Springsteen recorded Born in the USA there. Like, big Michael Jackson recorded, like, big records. And you walk into that, it doesn't exist anymore. That's the saddest part. But when you walked into that room, you just see all these gold and platinum records and you're taken aback. I was 22 years old, you know. I was like, what is going on here? And we recorded in Studio A, and that's the place where all of the records that you ever loved from that time period, that's where it was recorded, right? And so you just feel this vibe there, you know. It was a hard thing to put aside, but I remember it so vividly, you know, because it was just such a incredible place to be able to record. And so we made this record and we were really happy with it. And, you know, we went and went on tour and things were good. And then things weren't so good, you know, but that's kind of what happens sometimes.
Right. You know? And, you know, I want to get into something now, you know, the band, I believe you got played a couple of times on 120 Minutes with Jolene, the single mm-hmm. the record, and you guys were kind of right there. And then we're not going to go into the whole story, but I do want to show the perseverance and how there's ups and downs in this business. I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but I think this is kind of the story, and you can elaborate. Is the band kind of fizzled out late 99, and you kind of thought you were done with music. You were thinking about going to teach and do some other things. I know you were cooking at the time at a restaurant. You were kind of trying to figure out what the heck you were going to do. And then the opportunity to join Less Than Jake came up. So you never know where this career is going to take you. Can you talk about that interim, that 6 to 8 months where you were kind of lost?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was 6 to 8 months. It was kind of, it probably felt like 10 years, but it really was probably, it was probably 2 months, you know? And like the story goes, I was in the last semester of, you know, Jack had come home from touring and we were writing. And so I was in my last semester of college, right? Even though I had taken time off, I had 4 more months to get a degree. And it was the hardest part because I was going to school for education. So I had to do student teaching. So it was every day getting up 6 o'clock and going teaching every day, you know, Monday through Friday. And then Friday nights, I would drive back to Connecticut from Boston to work on songs or play gigs or whatever. So, and then on top of that, I was also working at a restaurant, you know, cooking just to try to make some extra money, you know, so I could pay my rent, pay my bills. So I don't know if I slept for that entire year, you know, maybe 2 hours here and there a night. I don't remember sleeping very much, but I remember getting a phone call from one of the members of Spring Hill Jack, and he was just couldn't be consoled about how much time I was spending in Boston and, you know, what my commitment was to the band and so on and so forth. And I remember just saying to him at some point, I was like, look, man, can you give me 2 months and then I'm done with school. I have this thing and then we're going, it's happening, you know? And I don't know, like I said, it just maybe, I remember my final quote to him was, well, maybe you can find somebody to do my job better than me because I think I'm done. And then that was it. In life, you can the only person that really knows what your self-worth is you. So if you don't have a high idea of yourself or a high thought of yourself, then why should anybody else, you know, mm-hmm. or why would anybody else think anything more of you? And I think maybe he thought he was just going to kind of like bully me into doing something that was right for him. But in my life, I've always done what I think is right for me, you know, and right. then if it happens to be right for the other people around me, then great. But, you know, at least I can go to sleep at night. And so after I quit Spring Hill Jack, or maybe they would say I was kicked out. I don't know. You can ask. You could probably ask them, but I'm pretty sure I quit. And, you know, I was just like, well, the hell with this. I'm going to focus on student teaching. I'm going to focus on this job. And, you know, I'm living in Boston. I'll just keep living in Boston and doing this thing, you know? And so it was, to be honest with you, man, I was student teaching in Newton, Massachusetts at this high school called Newton South. And the music director there at the time, he was like, I was getting towards the end of my student teaching. He's like, look, I really like you. We don't have a job here, but I want to create a job for you here. So if
oh, wow.
you're interested,
I didn't know that.
Let's, oh yeah. He's like, so if you're interested, we should talk about this more, you know? And so here I had this opportunity and like, I was making okay money working at a restaurant, you know, for being 22 or 23 or whatever I was at the time, you know? And then I got a phone call from this guy, and his name was Vinny, and he played drums in this band called Less Than Jake. I knew who Less Than Jake was. You know, I wasn't a fan, so to speak. I knew who the band was. I knew Losing Streak and I knew Automatic. Right. Those were the songs. And I knew Johnny Quest Thinks We're Sellouts. Right. Yeah. Those were the three things that I knew about Less Than Jake. But I remember playing a show with you guys in New Jersey somewhere. Maybe it was Rutgers. And I was like,
it was Rutgers.
And I remember you guys pulling up and you're in the blue and white. And I remember you guys just, I was sitting in our van and I remember you guys literally falling out of the van. Like I'd never seen anything. I was like, what is this chaos that is coming at us? Look at what they're traveling in. How is yeah. that thing? You know what I mean? Like, I was like, what is this? And like, I was, you know, we played our set. And then I remember watching you guys and I was like, what is going on? This is total chaos. And then fast forward to Warped Tour, right? I watched you guys in Orlando because your tour manager was a friend of mine and he brought me up on stage.
Yeah.
And you had some sort of collaboration going on with Yoo-Hoo or something. And I just remember you guys throwing Yoo-Hoos off stage and you were dressed up. I'll never forget it. Like these mirror sunglasses, a curly wig, a baseball trucker hat, a button down like
Yoo-Hoo shirt,
work shirt, Yoo-Hoo shirt, right?
Yeah.
And some whatever. And there's just chaos on stage. I don't know who's in the band. I don't know what is going on. I just hear music and I'm watching this. It's literal chaos on stage, right? And I'm going, what is going, what is this? What is this? And so when Vinny called me, he's like, hey, you know, we're interested in having you come try out for the band. And I'm like, okay, I don't know any songs, you know? And to be honest with you, I was at a point in my life where I didn't know if I really wanted to get back into being in a band.
Yeah. I knew that.
Dealing with that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like I had just had kind of a traumatic experience and, you know, between the first two, and I was just like, do I want to keep chasing the rabbit, you know, or do I just want to like fall into something that's a little more safe, you know?
Right.
You know, you guys were getting ready to go on tour and Vinny's like, well, I'll send you some CDs. I don't have the note anymore. I thought I did, but I'll never forget it. It was the first four records. And the note that he wrote in there was, Pete, hear the CDs, learn some tunes, Vinny. No set list, no like, what should I learn? Just like, throw the records in, bro, figure it out. And I'm like, dude, you know, learning one record worth of material is enough, but learning four records worth of material is, you know, especially stuff I don't even know what I'm dealing with. So I remember I put in Pezcore. And I couldn't hear the horn parts. And
no,
I was like, this
that, that record, how could you? Yeah. It was
and
mixed
was
poorly.
Like, I mean, you guys recorded it in a day. You know what I mean? And so that's, but I didn't know all this stuff. I'm just like, how am I going to listen to this? Whatever. And so I put in Hello Rock You. Right. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I can get into. And like that became the record that I focused on for the first whatever week that I was recording. Or practicing, and then I, you know, tried Losing Streak and whatever. And I remember the night before or two nights before I flew down to Florida, I called Vinny. You guys had gotten back, and I was just like, and he's like, what's up? And I go, hey man, I just wanted to touch base. Like, you know, I kind of learned the songs. I'm like, I don't know if I'm gonna do what you guys want me to do. I go, I don't know what you're looking for. And he was just, I'll never forget this. He's like, look, man, the guy that's down here now, he's gone home. That's it. Like,
Well, I was going to say we had one other guy that had flown in for the audition and it was between you and him and we knew it wasn't working out then. So you were kind of like the Hail Mary at that point.
Yeah. And I was like, and he's like, well, you're either going to pack for 3 days or 2 weeks because you're either going to be here for 3 days. Or you're going to be here for 2 weeks. And I said, all right, I packed for 2 weeks because I knew that I was going to be there. You know, and that's when that was the point that I knew that I wanted to do this.
Well, and unbeknownst to you at that, you know, kind of turmoil in your life, trying to figure out what you want to do, maybe teach this whole thing happening with us, unbeknownst to you, you were setting yourself up for the second half of your life, for at least the second half of your musical career, because it's been 21 years now that you've been in this band, which is crazy to think. And I want to ask you a couple more things before we wrap up here. It could be even before Less Than Jake, but what is if you were to pick one pinnacle moment, what's a highlight of your musical career? Something that stands out, a performance, a song you record, a song you wrote, what is it?
That's a hard question because I don't live in the past, you know, I live in the now, or I try to be present and I try to look forward. That's really a hard question. I don't know. I don't have an answer.
That's an answer.
Yeah, I mean, every time I think that this is it, this is the best I've ever done. This is the best. I do something that I'm like, well, this is better. You know,
yeah.
I do that. I say that to Buddy a lot. I'll be like, dude, this is the best song I've ever written. And then he goes, but what about the one that you said was the last best song you ever written? And I'm like, well, you're right. But that's kind of what it is.
I'm glad you said that because that forward momentum with anything in life, but especially in this career path of choosing music, if you want to do this, it's like there are ups and downs every time you turn around. There's always detractors. People aren't going to like your song, this and that. And you just got to keep the blinders on and keep moving forward. So I think that's a great, I think that's a great thing that you said to be able to admit that. I mean, obviously there's always highlights in a career, but I respect that you're looking forward.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. We've done so many cool things, Chris, you know, and you've been there standing next to me for a lot of them that
yeah,
it's just hard to pick one and go, this was the one. I mean, I don't know. I guess it was cool that time that when Rick Nielsen handed you his guitar. When we played with Cheap Trick, that was cool. And that had nothing to do with me. I was just sitting there watching it all happen. You know what I mean?
I didn't think that for a second that'd be something, you know, Buddy had mentioned the Bon Jovi tour, which of course is a highlight because of just the complete insanity and ridiculousness of that whole thing, you know?
And, yeah.
And you're right. There has been so many highlights and we've been right next to each other. Before we break here, if there's one piece of advice you could give to someone aspiring to be a musician or performer, what would it be?
Focus on the things that you can control. Don't focus on the things that are out of your control because you'll drive yourself crazy. Like sitting around and going, well, why did they do this? Don't worry about what they are doing. Worry about what you do and focus on making what you do the best that it can be. You know, realize what your strengths are. Highlight those. Don't try to be something that you're not. That's the best advice that I could give somebody.
Well, I think that's very sound advice. I appreciate that. And I appreciate you sitting in and taking us on your journey today.
Thank you. This is fun.
Hey, you. Do you have any plans this year? Ha! How's that going? Did you get 2020'd? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020'd, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020'd.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.